What we saw last week in chapter 23, that Joshua admitted he was old, advanced in age. Now the very final chapter of the book of Joshua is before us tonight, and we will read about the death of Joshua at 110 years of age. So he was right, he was old. He was advanced in age, advanced in years. In Hebrews 9, the writer of the book says, "It is appointed for every man to die once. And after this, the judgment." I was having this conversation with my son this week as he brought up death. We were talking about this appointment that we all have. And it's an appointment that we will all keep. You may be the kind that is on time for an appointment or maybe a little bit late for an appointment. I don't know. Some people are notoriously late for their appointments. If they say 6:30, they mean 6:45 or 7. You can just count on it. And so some of those kinds of people, you want to tell them a different time so they'll be there at the right time. But there is an appointment that you will all keep, whether you're on time or late. All of you will keep your appointment with death. It is appointed to every one of you once to die, and after this, the judgment. Now, that is the reality we started talking about last week. It's the reality Joshua faces at the end of this book, being 110 years of age. A full life, a great life, but now it's over. It's time to go the way of all the earth, to pass as he did with his fathers, to go into eternity, as we will all do one day. Death sort of seems, I think, more in our culture, modern society, a bit unreal for a few factors. Number one, you could turn on the television and you'll see an episode where somebody dies in the show. But then another movie later, he's acting another part. So he died, but he really didn't die. He just acted like he died. And though the music was playing and people were crying as the hero died, he's back again in the second presentation or feature. Also, there are people who really have died historically, but because of the reruns, again, the marvel of technology and television, you see them over and over and over again. Marilyn Monroe, you can still see her. James Dean, you can still see him. He'd been dead a long time. Or they live on through their music. You can hear their voices still. But death is real. We will all face it. It's appointed to every man to die once, and after this, the judgment. What is recorded in the last two chapters of Joshua is the final will and testament of the man Joshua. It's his last words. I've often wondered what my last words will be. Of course, we may not have the luxury to have a deathbed experience, and we know that we're passing off the scene, we know we're going into eternity, and here's our final words. We may just say goodnight to someone, that could be our final words, and we die on the way home. You never know. But there is a difference in the way people die. People who know the Lord and face death have a quite different experience from those who do not. I think of a couple notable examples. Voltaire, the unbeliever. He was called the French infidel who mocked and knocked Christianity. He died a very cruel death. And toward the end of the evening, as he was crying out, and his nurse said he cried out through the entire night, wailing. He said, "I am in the flames. I am abandoned by God and by man. I shall go to hell, O Christ, O Jesus Christ." And he cried that through the night. And his nurse who attended him, she said, "I never want to watch the death of another unbeliever for all the money in the world." When Mahatma Gandhi died, a great leader of the Indian people, bringing them into a revolution, in many ways. Still, toward the end of his life, the last day of his life, he said, "All about me is darkness. I am praying for light. For the first time in 50 years, I find myself in the slough of despond. It was a very, very miserable, desperate time. Now you compare that with some of the words we've been reading about Joshua, and especially chapter 24, where he stands up at 110 years of age and says, "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Choose this day whom you will serve." Of course, he might have said it like, "As for me and my house," but he still said it. Great way to end your life. Chapter 24 now is a chapter dedicated to addressing the nation as a whole, however they could get together and in whatever manner they could listen to his feeble voice at the end of his 110 years. They are there, the leadership, the people. And Joshua does what many others did before him and do after him. He goes through the history of the nation. Writing wasn't what it is today. There were no computers, no email, no typewriters. Things were very primitive, and so they retold the story lest the next generation forget it, which, by the way, they will. And so he tells the story of what God has done in the past, historical review. This is what God has done for you. Therefore, do this, knowing that God has done this for you. Now, sometimes people will say it's never good to look back. The past is the past, let bygones be bygones, and I agree with that to an extent. But I also think that since you and I cannot foresee the future, except for what is revealed in the Word of God, you cannot predict your own future. You have no certainty of what will happen in your life tomorrow or the next day. All you have is the past. And when you have had God in your past, it's great, it's glorious. You now have a frame of reference. You can look back at the track record and say, well, God has done this, and he has done that, and look what God did here. Because God has done all of those things, and I've watched it, I've experienced it, I now have great confidence for my future. In looking at the past and seeing God in my life in the past, I have hope, because I know God will be with me in the future. And so Joshua sort of takes that approach, and he goes through this historical overview, and there's a couple things to notice. First thing to notice is about 18 times there's the personal pronoun I, capital I, used. This is God speaking. God, through the mouth of Joshua, tells the children of Israel, I did this, I did this, I did that. And clearly the emphasis is not on what you must do for God, but the emphasis is on what God will do, has done, and is doing for you. And we'll see how this interacts, because there is a time where we say, because God has done this, my response to him is such and such. And Joshua gets to that. But first, he goes through the history. In going through the history, there are three bodies of water mentioned. I think it's sort of interesting. The first body of water is the Euphrates River. It's the first crossing. And that's in the area where they're bombing tonight. The Persian Gulf. That's where Abraham is from. They're bombing the area of Abraham tonight. But each body of water represents a separation, a brand new start, a brand new life. So there's the Euphrates River. Then there's the Red Sea, the crossing of Israel from Egypt into the wilderness and eventually into the Promised Land. And the third body of water mentioned, of course, is the Jordan River, which is the setting historically of the book of Joshua. When it comes to the Euphrates River, there's a separation. Abraham left Ur of the Chaldees, left pagan worship, the worship of the moon god and the goddesses of that area, and had a whole new life as God called him to a new land, the Promised Land. So there was a separation for him. Then, the second body of water, the Red Sea, same kind of a thing. They left the gods of Egypt. They left the comfort and the security of Egypt, and they're now out in the wilderness, trusting only God for their daily sustenance, for their direction. There's again a separation. Egypt is on one side. The pagan gods and goddesses are on that side. It's just us and God on this side. And then crossing into the land of Canaan. Again, that separation. We're leaving the past behind. We're leaving the failure behind of the wilderness wandering for 40 years. Here's a new start. So keep that in mind as we go through the book. Then Joshua, verse 1, chapter 24, gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem. This is in the center of the hill country, the center of the land. This is their headquarters. And called for the elders of Israel, for their heads, for their judges, for their officers, and they presented themselves before God. And Joshua said to all the people, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, your fathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham, and the father of Nahor, dwelt on the other side of the river," that's the Euphrates River, "in old times, and they served other gods. And then I took your father Abraham from the other side of the river, led him throughout all the land of Canaan, and multiplied his descendants, and gave him Isaac. To Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau. To Esau I gave the mountains of Seir to possess, but Jacob and his children went down to Egypt. I also sent Moses and Aaron, and I plagued Egypt according to what I did among them. Afterward I brought you out." The first biographical sketch is that of Abraham. And Joshua makes sure that the children of Israel understand that there was a separation. God called him out from something. Abraham lived among idol worshipers. His father, his grandfather, worshipped, well, the principal god of Ur of the Chaldees, that was his town by the Euphrates River, a very, very rich and important city. The chief goddess was Nana. That was the moon goddess. They worshiped nature. So even Abraham, this trophy of faith, used over and over again as an example of faith throughout the New Testament, even Abraham was called out of something, idol worship, and called to serve God, the only true God, in a very new way, in a new land. Now this is sort of a pattern we see through the whole Bible, where God calls people out of something into something. Not just out of something and not just into something, but both out of something and into something. That's what repentance is. You turn from that which you know is wrong. You turn to God. You leave Ur of the Chaldees, Nana, the moon goddess, Baal, etc., and you turn toward God and serve the living God, the only true God. This is one of the themes in the New Testament book of Thessalonians. When in 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 9, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Paul writes to them and he says, "You serve the Lord and you turned from idols to serve the living God." Turning from, turning to, a separation out of idolatry to serve the living and the true God. In a few weeks' time, a group of us, 25 or 30 of us, are going to be in India, which is a very different country from, well, any country I've ever been to, especially this country. It is the antithesis of everything this country is. It is an assault on all of your senses. It's the best way I can describe India. It's an assault on your sense of smell. No, nothing further needs to be said on that. I'm sure you get the picture. But your olfactory senses are very heightened in that country. It's an assault on your ears because everything is noisy, it seems like, all of the time. It's an assault on your sense of sight because you see things you never knew existed. So your senses are just, it's like an overload mode most of the time. One of the things that is most notable is the amount of idol worship. Shrines virtually everywhere. Well, in a country of 330 million gods, you would expect lots of shrines. They're everywhere. And you'll watch people as they bow down to them and offer food offerings and put their jewelry on top of the statues and pay homage, laying prostrate and talking to them for hours. Whenever there is a conversion in countries like India, in Asian countries where there's a lot of idolatry, conversion is a very public thing. You think having an altar call is public? It is. But it's even more public in a country like that. Usually what they will do is they will take their idols, their gods, if they have any around the house, and they usually carry them out. And the Christians will parade down the main street of their town in white robes, usually, because they're going to be baptized, symbolizes purity, and they will take their idols, get rid of them, burn them, or dispose of them, and then march down into a body of water, a lake, or a river, and be baptized. Which, number one, incurs persecution. They're making a statement to everybody, we're no longer part of this culture, we're no longer part of this system. But number two, it is making a very dramatic statement, hence the persecution. They are saying, Jesus Christ is victorious and greater than all of these gods. And he has conquered in my life this day the idolatry. It makes a great impact. And that's why when we baptize in places like that, you generally see many of the townspeople come out to observe just who it is that's making this break. It's great. Making a stand for Jesus Christ. So he's telling them, Joshua is saying that even Abraham, the trophy of faith, came from a culture filled with idols, and he was called out of it. Something else I want you to notice in verse 3 and 4. I took your father Abraham from the other side of the river, led him through the land of Canaan, multiplied his descendants, and gave him who? Isaac. Well, what about Ishmael? God gave him Ishmael, did he? Well, Ishmael was the son of the flesh. It was sort of a deal that was worked out with Hagar, his handmaiden, and Sarah, his wife. But he did have another son. In fact, he was the firstborn son, and according to the cultures of the Semitic groups, the Semites, Ishmael would have had the right of the firstborn being born first, but he was not the son of the promise. So Ishmael is not mentioned, but Isaac is. And then it says, to Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau. To Esau I gave the mountains of Seir to possess. They became the Edomites over where the Jordanians are today. But Jacob and his children went down to Egypt. And I sent Moses and Aaron and plagued Egypt according to what I did among them. Afterward, I brought them out. This brings up an issue. And it's the issue of the Middle East peace process. Now, listen, I'm not a diplomat. You don't want me in the United Nations. I think that's very clear. But there's always been this fight in that part of the world, and the kind of things you hear about the skirmishes and the Palestinians and the Israelis, which seems to make headline news every day. It's the same headlines I remember since I was a little kid. Just the names have changed, but it's exactly the same headlines. Skirmish with the Palestinians and the Israelis, and I've heard that for years. So it's really not new news, and it's been going on before I was born and you were born. It goes all the way back to this time. Whenever we deal with rights, and of course we live in a culture that's very right-oriented, human rights, civil rights, personal rights, I guess my question in the midst of that debate of whose right is what right is whose, who gets the right to dictate what rights everybody else has? The answer, ultimately, the only Christian worldview perspective, is God does. So let's apply that now to the land of Israel. This land of, as some people call it, Palestine. Whose land is it? Does it belong to Israel? Does it belong to the Arabs? Whose land is it? Actually, both those answers are wrong. Let me give you four quick facts. Fact number one, the land belongs to God, Leviticus chapter 25. He said, this land, the land of Canaan, shall not be sold permanently, for it is mine. So it belongs to God. He holds the title deed. It's his land. If there's any reason why it's called the Holy Land, that's it. It's not holy because the people in it are holy. Definitely not. In fact, if you ever take a tour there, you take a tour of the unholy land. The only reason it's holy is because God claims right to it. Fact number two, though it belongs to God, God gave it, or you might say, as a stewardship to take care of, he gave it to Abraham. Right? Genesis chapter 12, the first promise. He gets called out of Ur of the Chaldees, and God says, I am the Lord God. I am your exceeding great reward. To you and your descendants I will give this land that you are in as an inheritance forever. And in you all the nations, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Speaking of the Messiah, tied to the land. Fact number three, Abraham had two sons. One of them is promised the right to the land by God. There was Ishmael, but there was also Isaac, the son of promise, this miraculous birth in their old age. Now there was a time when Abraham didn't want to go through the hassle of having this old age birth and this son of promise. And he just says, oh God, just let Ishmael live before you. Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. And God said, no. But your wife, Sarah, will conceive, not Hagar, Sarah. And she will have a son, and you're going to call him Isaac. And in him, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. I'll make a covenant with him. And this is his land. The next fact, number four. Isaac also had two sons. One of them was given the land of Israel by God as a promise, the same promise that he gave to Abraham and to Isaac, he gave to Jacob, not Esau, though Esau was the firstborn. Remember, Rebekah had two sons. They were twins. One came out first. He was all hairy and red, so they called him Hairy and Red. That's what Esau means, hairy and red. Well, as soon as Harry came out of the womb, another baby came out with its hand grabbing the heel of Harry. And so they looked and they saw this funny phenomena, and Dad said, we're going to call him heel catcher. That's what Yaakov means, Jacob. Supplanter or heel catcher, one who trips the other one up. And boy, did he live up to his name. But nonetheless, though it was undeserved, God promised to Jacob that land. Now what happened later on? Esau, though he was the firstborn and he was in line from his father to receive and inherit the blessing of the land, didn't want his birthright. So he sold it to his brother Jacob for a bowl of green chili stew. Putting it in a local vernacular. A bowl of porridge. He didn't care about the spiritual inheritance, didn't care about the things of God. He just wanted some food because his brother Jacob was a connoisseur, was a great chef. Until later on, when it came time for the blessing, Jacob tricked his father, dressed up, and made himself smell really bad, like Harry smelled all the time. Came in, and his dad had poor eyesight and thought it was Esau, and conferred the blessing and the land blessing to him. You might say, well, even though that happened, Skip, it was a trick. I mean, how could God bless that? It was a trick. He tricked his brother, he tricked his father, and yet he gets the land. Well, later on, as he's running away, do you remember the story? He's running out, and he puts his head on a rock somewhere out in the middle of the boonies in Israel, and there's a lot of them. He's sleeping uneasy that night, and he has a vision. And it's a ladder going all the way up into heaven from earth, and the angels of God are descending and ascending on it. And on the other side of the ladder, above the ladder, is God. And God says, I am the Lord thy God, the God of your father Abraham and Isaac. And the place where you are lying, this land, I'm going to give to you and to your descendants forever. So he didn't deserve it. Neither do you deserve God's goodness. It's a model of grace. He was a scoundrel. But the prophecy came at the beginning. The elder shall serve the younger. So God promised that Abraham, that Isaac, and that Jacob would have it. Then later on, Jacob has a wrestling match with God. Remember that story? With the angel of the Lord till the breaking of the day. And God changes his name from Jacob to Israel, one who fights victoriously with God. And at that point again, God promises him the land as a possession forever. Well, what happened, and I have nothing against the Ishmaelites, I have nothing against the family of Esau. God promised them actually a lot more land. They had a lot more descendants, they got a lot of land. And so they moved east of the Jordan to the high plateaus of what is today Jordan and the land of Edom. And so he's recounting the story. It, of course, has taken me a lot longer to recall the story than it took him. It just took him a sentence, but for the sake of explanation, to get you on the same page. Verse 5, I sent Moses and Aaron and plagued Egypt according to what I did among them. Afterwards, I brought you out. Then I brought your fathers out of Egypt, and you came to the sea. That's the Red Sea, the second body of water, separation. And the Egyptians pursued your fathers with chariots and horsemen to the Red Sea. So they cried out to the Lord, and he put darkness between you and the Egyptians, brought the sea upon them, and covered them. and your eyes saw what I did in Egypt. Then you dwelt along in the wilderness a long time. Of course, that's an understatement, isn't it? A long time would be 40 years. That's a long time to be out in the desert. No running water. In tents. Have you ever gone camping for a long time? I can handle maybe a week. I've gone a couple weeks. But you know what? Actually, I've gone 3 months at one time. Or 2.5 months as I toured the United States. But I'll tell you what. 40 years. It's like inconceivable. It shouldn't have taken them 40 years. It should have taken them 11 days, according to Deuteronomy chapter 1. That's what Moses said. From Mount Sinai to Kadesh Barnea, it's about 150, 200 miles, depending if you go around this rock or around the other rock. It's 150 to 200 miles. Should have taken them 11 days. Took them 40 years because of unbelief. And they wandered around out in this desert. So he sums it all up. You guys were out there a long time. He's being gracious. You do that when you age. And I brought you into the land of the Amorites, who dwell on the other side of the Jordan, and they fought with you, but I gave them into your hand that you might possess their land, and I destroyed them before you. Then Balak, the son of Zippor, the king of Moab, arose to make war against Israel and sent and called Balaam, the son of Beor, to curse you. But I would not listen to Balaam, therefore he continued to bless you. So I delivered you out of his hand. You see what Joshua is doing? He's recalling their history, but not all of it. He's summing up great portions of it, but bringing out and highlighting with some detail other portions of it, just to show God's involvement. It's interesting that he brings up Balaam. The story is something like this. The king of Moab, now remember, they're traversing a large portion of land as they come from Egypt through the desert into the promised land. They go through Moab. Well, the king of Moab was a guy named Balak. And Balak, from a vantage point, could see the millions of people coming in to take over his land. He was scared, and he ought to be. He had seen, or at least he heard the reports of what happened to the Amorites and Og and Sihon, the two kings that were destroyed of the Amorites. And so he's thinking, man, I'm dead. And so he hires a prophet named Balaam. Now, I've got to hand it to Balak. As much as you may not like the guy because he's trying to curse the children of Israel, he recognizes the spiritual principle. The spiritual principle is this. These children of Israel, if you're going to fight them, you can't use carnal methods. If we're going to defeat them at all, we have to meet them on their terms. Since they trust this God they call on, Yahweh, since they're a spiritual people, a nation centered around spirituality, the only way to fight them is using spiritual stuff. So they hired a prophet, a false prophet named Balaam. Let me tell you a little bit about Balaam, because he is a confusing character. It is thought that Balaam was, well, his title would be an Arcadian priest prophet, a diviner. Mesopotamian Baru would be the authentic title. He was a diviner. You know what diviners did? They were superstitious. They looked at things like entrails of animals, like livers, depending on which way the liver would wiggle, that would be a sign to them. Or they would put drops of oil inside water and the patterns would tell them something, just like a palm reader. They would look at the stars and they would decide the future based on the stars, or position of clouds, you know, would form certain pictures in the sky, and so they would prophesy based on these superstitious animistic things. So that was Balaam. But as much as Balaam tried to curse the children of Israel, God wouldn't let him. He blessed the children of Israel. So God was even protecting them from the falseness. I would not listen to Balaam, therefore he continued to bless you, so I delivered you out of his hand. The nations of the world, speaking of the Middle East peace process, should cop a clue. And just look a little bit at history when it comes to dealing with the nation of Israel. God made a promise to this forefather, Abraham. He said, I'm going to give you this land. And by the way, Abe, whoever blesses you, I will bless. And you know what? Whoever curses you, I will curse. So you look at history, you look at the nations of the world. At one time, they were great nations, even world-governing empires. Babylon ruled the earth. Babylon attacked Israel. Babylon is not a world-governing empire. Egypt ruled the earth, was a world-governing empire, attacked Israel. Egypt became less in strength as time went on. Nazi Germany. And we could recall nation after nation after nation that I believe has, through history, underwent the judgment of God simply because of their stance against the nation of Israel. Now, I wish I could convince policyholders in our nation to keep that in mind, though they would consider that superstition. It's a matter of historical record. I will bless those that bless you and curse those that curse you. Verse 11, then you went over the Jordan. You came to Jericho. Here's the third river, the third crossing, the Jordan River. You came to Jericho. The men of Jericho fought against you, also the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, the Termites. Just wanted to see if you were with me. But I delivered them into your hand. I sent the hornet before you, which drove them out from before you, also the two kings of the Amorites, but not with your sword or with your bow. Now listen to this. This is what I did. Listen to the pronouns. I did this, I did that, not with your sword, not with your bow. Of course, Jericho, I mean, how hard was that for the children of Israel? Man, honey, we had a hard battle today. Really, what was it like? Well, we just blowed a bunch of horns and the walls fell down. Really? So you had to have good musicians, huh? Because the soldiers didn't do anything. God miraculously did it. Now, there was some fighting involved, but the point is, God was clearly taking the initiative. I have given you a land, verse 13, for which you did not labor, and cities which you did not build, and you dwell in them. You eat the vineyards, the olive groves, which you did not plant. Now, therefore, fear the Lord, serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river in Egypt. Serve the Lord. All the pronouns, I have done this. I dispossess them. I put you in this land. It's not because of you. This is not an awards banquet for the children of Israel. Have you ever been to awards banquets and there's always accolades? And we have a wonderful person over here. And you know, there's none of this here. The record is set straight. In spiritual matters, we have to really be careful about getting credit. Sometimes I'll hear speakers introduced, you know, who's going to be a guest speaker, or I've been introduced, and sometimes the introduction I get embarrassed by. I mean, and we have with us tonight, and he's this, and he's that. I'm thinking, man, I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say. This God is saying, I've done it. You haven't done anything. Because I've done this, you have a response. And the response is in verse 14. You can't take credit for it. This is the logical response. Now, therefore, because of this, fear the Lord, serve him in sincerity and truth. If God has done that much for me, if God has done that much for our nation, the nation of Israel, then the logical response would be to serve God. This is the approach, by the way, of Paul the Apostle in most of his letters in the New Testament. This is what Paul does, just if you want to know how he writes generally. His outline is doctrinal and then practical. He usually tells you what God has done, who you were, or the blessings that God has given to us that we have incurred because we have a relationship with him. And he usually does that in the first part of the book, and somewhere there's a transition of therefore, and he gets very practical. Because this is true, therefore, this is our response. Romans chapter 12, verse 1. After spending 11 chapters talking about God's plan for the Gentiles, the Jews, the world, life of faith, etc., justification, sanctification, glorification, the pivotal chapter is chapter 12. I beseech you, therefore, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. Better translation, your logical ministry. In fact, the Greek word logikos. As you look back at all that God has done for you, if you're a thinking person, you'll apply logic, and that logical response is, man, who wouldn't serve God? with all that he's done. I want to do this. Not I have to do it, I want to. It's reasonable. That's also his approach in the book of Ephesians. Now, therefore, fear doesn't mean shake like the scarecrow in the Wizard of Oz or the lion who had no courage. The idea, as you know, in the Bible, fear means a healthy reverence or respect. The only phobia that I would have, the actual fear, is that I wouldn't please the Lord. That's where the fear part comes in. Fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in truth. Put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river in Egypt. Serve the Lord. There's three parts to spiritual growth. Revelation, experience, and service. God reveals himself to you. You soak it in. You underline it. You get a grasp of it. Then you experience it. That needs to be the second portion. You just don't read about it, what God did for them, but God has done something for me. Changes are going on in my life. I experience it for myself. And then third, the logical response, serving him. Being involved in the work of the Lord. All of those things promote growth. So let me ask you this. We've been in Joshua now for many, many studies. What are you going to do with these studies? What are you going to do with them? A commission is given to us. A mantle is being passed to us. You know, we've said this before, but Bible knowledge is very dangerous. In fact, Bible knowledge is a lot like manna. Remember manna? They'd pick it up. They had to pick it up every day or it would rot. If they didn't use what they pick up, and you do it every day, a little bit at a time, and you can't leave any over. That which you don't use rots, and so it is with Bible knowledge. As we understand something about God, the key is to experience it and then to respond to it in service. And that's the point that he is driving home in these last words. And if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. Make a choice, make a decision. Whether the gods which your fathers served, who are on the other side of the river, that's the Euphrates, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. What a gutsy old guy. You know, when you are older, you can say things, by the way, and get away with a lot more. Have you noticed that? I say use it to your advantage. Use it for the gospel. Be bold. He was bold. And he calls them to make a definite choice, a definite surrender, a definite commitment. Who does this sound like? Does it sound like another character that you've read about? Choose this day whom you will serve. Elijah. On Mount Carmel, 1 Kings chapter 18. Again, a gutsy prophet. Nobody else is with him. He's sort of all alone. Of course, Joshua has other people who are in God's army. But Elijah stands up on Mount Carmel and challenges all the false prophets to a contest. A lot of them. 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of Asherah. A false goddess, the cohort of Baal, and says to the children of Israel, how long will you falter between two opinions? Or how long will you hop between two forks in the road? They couldn't make a decision. Should I serve God? Should I serve Baal? Baal, God. They couldn't decide. So he says, make a choice. If Baal is God, serve him. But if God, the God of Israel, be the Lord, then serve him. So he drew the line in the sand. Told them to make a choice. In every church, there are people who fall into camps of commitment. There are some people who are sold out to Jesus Christ. Sold, they'll do anything. They're in love with God. They want everything in their life to be glorifying and pleasing to God, their marriage, their business, their finances, their thoughts, everything, Lord, it's for you. Then there are others who are definitely not committed to God. They may attend, probably not long. They may get mad, or they may get hardened as time goes on, but they're definitely not committed. But there's a vast crowd in between who is, well, kind of committed, but kind of not committed, sort of in between. So it's important to call upon people to make a choice. Choose this day whom you will serve. Jesus did that. You're either for me or against me. You either help gather or you scatter. There's a poem I remember hearing as a young Christian that goes something like this. There is a time, we know not when, a line we know not where, that marks the destiny of man twixt sorrow and despair. There is a line, though by man unseen, once it has been crossed, even God in all his love hath sworn that all is lost. So make a choice. Which side will you be on? Will you be on God's side? Or you might say, well, listen, don't pressure me here, preacher. I'm not against God. I want you to know that. I'm really not against Jesus. He's a fine person. You know, a lot of people have this Sunday school view of Jesus. He's just a nice Boy Scout who helps little old ladies across the Sea of Galilee, etc. But he's not God in human flesh. He can't claim lordship over my life. So I'm not against him. But I'm not for him like you are. You're a little bit on the edge. You're a little bit a fanatic. Well, let me tell you something. You've already decided against him, according to Jesus. If you're not for him, you are against him. If you don't gather in the kingdom, in effect, you scatter. You're the antithesis of his will. So he called people to make a choice, as does Joshua. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. So the people answered and said, far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. For the Lord our God is he who brought us and our fathers out of the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage, who did these great signs in our sight and preserved us in all the way that we went and among all the people through whom we passed. And the Lord drove out from before us all the people, even the Amorites who dwell in the land. We also will serve the Lord, for he is our God. But Joshua said to the people, you cannot serve the Lord, for he is holy God. He is jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions nor your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, then he will turn and do you harm and consume you after he has done you good. And the people said to Joshua, no, but we will serve the Lord. It almost sounds like Joshua is contradicting himself. Maybe you think, well, it's an age thing, 110, you know, he's not making clear, cogent sense. In effect, what he's doing is challenging them. You can't serve the Lord in your own strength, in your own power. You can't do it on your own. You certainly can't do it and cling to these false gods. You're going to have to make the choice to get rid of them. It was kind of putting up the wall to see if they're going to jump over it. And they make the commitment again, a second affirmation. No, we're going to serve the Lord. So Joshua said to the people, you are witnesses against yourselves that you have chosen the Lord for yourselves to serve him. And they said, we are witnesses. Now therefore, he said, put away the foreign gods which are among you, and incline your heart to the Lord God of Israel. And the people said to Joshua, the Lord our God, we will serve, and his voice we will obey. So Joshua made a covenant with the people that day, and made for them a statute and an ordinance in Shechem. And Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law of God. That is, he added it to the five books before him, the books of Moses. And he took a large stone and set it up under the oak that was by the sanctuary of the Lord. Joshua said to all the people, behold, this stone shall be a witness to us. It has heard all the words of the Lord which he spoke to us. It shall therefore be a witness to you, lest you deny your God. So Joshua let the people depart, each to his own inheritance. It's an interesting way to phrase this. You put up a rock and you say, now, this rock heard everything you said. This rock is a witness, as if the rock could speak. But then I remember, my mind goes forward from this point historically to the time when Jesus finally comes into Jerusalem and is proclaimed their Messiah. And he rides on a donkey, and the people with palm branches are all excited. It's near Passover, and they say, Hosanna in the highest. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And they give him the accolades and the recognition that he is Mashiach. He is the Messiah of the Jews. And as they're praising him, some of the Jewish leaders say, Teacher, rebuke your disciples. Tell them to not say these things. These are clearly, they're saying that you're Messiah. And Jesus said, if these were to hold their peace, even the rocks would cry out. Now you almost have to go to Israel to appreciate that. Everywhere you look is rock. That is the most readily available building material. They don't build with wood. They don't have forests. They have lots of rock. And so they quarry it and they build things. So, you know, if these hold their peace, the rocks will cry out. What rocks? The whole country is a rock. And I've often wondered, as I've looked at the stones on the Wailing Wall and all the stones around the Mount of Olives, if these stones could talk. What they have seen, what they have heard over the years, what they would tell, what story they would tell. And then when I read that passage that I mentioned in the gospel, I always wished that the disciples actually would have held their peace. It'd be neat if Jesus would have said, hold it, boys, just to hear the rocks cry out. It would, of course, be the first rock concert in history then, wouldn't it? Oh, I set you up for that one. Forgive me. It's part of my warped sense of humor. I'm still a human. Now, it came to pass, end of the book, verse 29. Came to pass after these things that Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died being 110 years old. You know, it's about time, right? And they buried him within the border of his inheritance at Timnath-Serah. That was that wilderness desert spot, but he wanted it, which is in the mountains of Ephraim on the north side of Mount Gaash. Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had known all the works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. Joshua and the leaders lived a godly example, and it was their example as leaders that passed on the influence to the next generation. Leadership is always important. You know, I know people complain today, our kids, they don't respect authority. Well, look at the authority that they are called upon to respect. It's almost like you can't respect some of the authority. There's nothing respectable about them. And leaders are called upon to be an influence, a salt, and a light to a nation. Joshua was, the leadership was. And as long as they were around, they served. Very important. But a preview of whenever we get to it. Look over at chapter 2 of Judges. It's the same story. It's just put in a little bit different manner. Chapter 2, verse 8 of Judges. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died when he was 110 years old. They buried him within the border of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres, or just another name for that same place, in the mountains of Ephraim, the north side of Mount Gaash. When all the generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done for Israel. That's why it's important for parents to exemplify and pass on the legacy of truth to their children, but then long and pray for and give room for those kids, the next generation, to experience their own relationship with. If they don't experience their own work and move of God, they won't last long. If you're thinking, oh, now that I have children, I'm going to go to church and I'm going to expose them to Sunday school. Well, all it takes is a few years for them to get their cognitive reasoning skills together and find out that, oh, that's why mom and dad went to church, because I was old enough and they wanted me to get exposed to this stuff, but they never really lived it themselves. That is hypocrisy. They'll see through that and they can forsake the Lord much easier. So the leadership and the parents, and by the way, where did it all start? In the home. Joshua addressed these 3 million people not as their leader necessarily, but as the leader of his home. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. A nation is simply the sum of its families. And if the family is weakened, the nation is weakened. And if men won't stand up and take leadership and pray with their families and lead them spiritually, how can we look toward any kind of a future for our nation? It takes godly leaders, men and women. And I'm addressing men now at this point because of the context of this. Rise up and make the commitment. As for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. It's going to begin with me. I'm going to lead it in the Lord. Joshua did, and that's where it all began, that kind of a commitment. Verse 32. The bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel had brought up out of Egypt, they buried at Shechem, in the plot of ground which Jacob bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver, and which had become an inheritance of the children of Joseph. And Eleazar, the son of Aaron, died, and they buried him in a hill that belonged to Phinehas, his son, which was given him in the mountains of Ephraim. Ends with three burials. Burial of Joshua, burial of Joseph, and the burial here of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest. It's not an ending in defeat, it's an ending in victory, because the fact that Joseph's bones had been carried was his request in Genesis chapter 50. He was thinking, one day, the offspring is going to be in the land. And when you're there, bring my bones and bury them. So the fact that he's being buried where he longed to be buried, in the promised land, is a victory. God brought them into the land, and that which was anticipated in Genesis 50 is now fulfilled here at the end of the book of Joshua. So that's the book, and we ended just on time. Joshua is a historical book. Joshua is a practical book. We've been trying to bring lessons home to ourselves. But also Joshua is a prophetic book. Joshua is the Hebrew word or the Hebrew transliteration of the Greek Jesus. And just as Joshua brought the children of Israel into a new land and conquered the land, we anticipate the book of Revelation because of it. Our Joshua, Jesus, will eventually conquer the earth that is rightfully his. He'll take the scroll from the right hand of him who sits on the throne, Revelation 4 and 5. And he will rule and reign and have conquest to the entire earth, where we will rule and reign with him. So I always like to read Joshua and think of the full prophetic picture of another Joshua, our Savior.